Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are strapping ourselves in for a truly epic career trajectory, a path that starts in the trenches of low-budget alien splatterfests in New Zealand.
And somehow culminates in the mastery of Middle Earth, the conquest of Hollywood, and even the resurrection of history through groundbreaking technology.
We are diving deep into the world of Sir Peter Jackson.
It is, and I don't think this is an exaggeration, arguably one of the most transformative careers in modern cinema. I mean, born on Halloween, October 31st, 1961, in Wellington, New Zealand.
Right.
Jackson didn't just become a successful director. He essentially became an industrialist of imagination.
An industrialist of imagination. I like that.
And the numbers, well, they reflect that scale. He is currently the fourth highest grossing film director of all time.
Of all time.
With his films making... what is it? North of $6.5 billion worldwide.
That is just astronomical money. But yeah. The story of how he built that empire is the real mission for us today. We have a mountain of material detailing his completely self-taught origins, how he moved from, you know, experimenting with pinholes for gunshots to creating photorealistic fantasy worlds. We'll look at how he and his core collaborators, Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens, didn't just master storytelling.
They pioneered a whole technological infrastructure, WETA, which now influences everything from film to music preservation and even, and this is the bizarre part, bioscience.
This deep dive is absolutely for you, the learner, who wants to understand the methodology behind that kind of genius. We're tracing his trial and error path, exploring the massive turning points.
Like that deliberate, you know, successful pivot away from genre filmmaking in the mid-90s. That was a huge moment.
Exactly. And we'll analyze those fascinating side ventures, whether it's his obsessive passion for World War I aviation or his investment in technology that is literally aiming to bring back extinct creatures.
So we have to anchor this discussion with the key works that really define him.
Of course. The Lord of the Rings trilogy, which saw Return of the King win three personal Oscars for him alone.
The Hobbit trilogy, the intensely dark drama Heavenly Creatures.
And those truly immersive documentaries, They Shall Not Grow Old and The Beatles, Get Back.
He is a filmmaker who really defines modern blockbuster cinema.
Okay, let's unpack this monumental journey, starting right at the beginning.
Let's do it.
So let's ground ourselves in Pickeroo Bay, Wellington. This is where Jackson was raised by English immigrant parents. Joan, who worked in a factory and is a housewife, and William, or Bill, a wages clerk.
And the crucial identity marker here, the one that I think defines his entire technical approach,
is that he was entirely self-taught.
Completely. That lack of formal training is absolutely central to understanding him. He wasn't trained in a school to follow some established procedure. He learned editing, visual effects, and makeup through sheer necessity.
Just endless experimentation. Right?
Endless experimentation and relentless trial and error. His initial resources were so limited, so he just had to invent solutions on the fly.
And his early influences, they reveal a lot about his later work, too. They were incredibly eclectic. He loved the stop-motion magic of Ray Harryhausen.
The detailed supermarionation world of Thunderbirds and the subversive, just anarchic humor of Monty Python's Flying Circus.
You can literally see that collision of technical ambition, these detailed worlds, and a really dark sense of humor throughout his entire career.
But if you trace it back to a singular foundational inspiration, all the sources, they all point to one thing.
1933 classic.
King Kong.
Of course.
He cited it repeatedly as his favorite film, and we have evidence of his dedication from childhood. Around age 9, he was already attempting to remake it using his own, you know, crude stop-motion models.
That early drive, it just shows his immediate connection to the technical side of filmmaking. He didn't just love the story. He loved the mechanism of making the impossible look real.
That's it, exactly.
And that experimentation continued through his early short films, even with next to nothing in terms of a budget. We're talking about early efforts, like the World War II epic, the Dwarf Patrol.
The Dwarf Patrol, yeah.
Where his first special effects simulating gun muzzle flashes was achieved by manually poking pinholes in the actual film strip.
Incredible. And a James Bond spoof, Goldfinger. He was just constantly tinkering, even winning a special prize for the camera work in his 20-minute short, The Valley.
The ability to tinker, though, it required capital, even if it was just for film stock and a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings us to a 7-year stretch of incredible personal dedication. Jackson left Kapiti College at 16, and for 7 years, he worked full-time as a photo engraver for the Evening Post newspaper in Wellington.
And the sources really emphasize this. He lived at home during that entire period specifically to save money, every cent.
All to buy a proper 16mm camera.
Think about that commitment. 7 years of grinding, day in, day out work, just to fund his own education through the acquisition of tools.
That financial sacrifice was really the critical gateway to his early filmmaking. And it's also during this newspaper phase that he discovered J.R.R. Tolkien's work.
Specifically after watching Ralph Bakshi's 1978 animated Lord of the Rings adaptation.
Right, so the seed of Middle-earth was planted, but before the elves came the aliens.
And his career's first true defining phase. The Splatstick era.
Yes, from 1987 to 1992, we get the infamous Splatstick era. For you listeners who haven't encountered the term, it's... what is it?
It's essentially a marriage of highly graphic gore and practical effects, that's the splatter, combined with farce, absurdity, and speed, the slapstick.
So comedy that relies on excessive, often just absurd, violence.
And his first feature, Bad Taste, is the perfect example.
Bad Taste is legendary. Precisely because of its anarchic, decentralized production.
Yeah.
It was a chaotic splatter comedy about aliens who come to New Zealand to turn humans into food.
And it wasn't shot in a few weeks. It took years to complete. Jackson was working his day job full-time and shooting primarily on weekends.
And he relied entirely on his friends.
People working for free, often roped into acting, effects, production duties, with absolutely no prior experience.
And Jackson was right in the middle of the chaos. He played two acting roles himself, Derek and Robert, which famously resulted in that cliffside fight where he battled himself through clever editing.
The whole project was just running on fumes until the New Zealand Film Commission stepped in.
And that NZFC intervention is so crucial. Jim Booth, the executive director at the time, was somehow convinced of Jackson's raw ability, even if the film was completely bizarre.
And he injected the necessary finance to finish the project. Booth later left the commission to become Jackson's producer.
Which speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
About the palpable potential Jackson displayed, even when he was covered in fake alien vomit.
Absolutely. What's also essential in this period is the start of the collaboration that would define the rest of his career. Fran Walsh.
His life partner. Their creative relationship began right here, solidifying with Meet the Feebles in 1989.
She's been his co-writer ever since and his producer since The Fellowship of the Ring.
And the sources confirm that this writing collaboration initially included Stephen Sinclair and Danny Mulheron as they brainstormed projects, including, what was it? An unmade sequel to A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, that's right. But the next project they tackled together was Meet the Feebles.
Ah, Meet the Feebles. It's a dark black satire, a savage puppet film that essentially deconstructs The Muppet Show.
By turning it into a hyper-violent, drug-fueled, sexually explicit backstage comedy, Jackson himself noted that it had a quality of humor that alienates a lot of people.
Oh, I can imagine. It sounds like a tough, low-budget shoot that went weeks over schedule.
It was. It's the kind of film that only a group of young, fearless filmmakers with absolute creative freedom could produce.
Absolutely. And they follow that up with perhaps the zenith of the splatter phase,
yep.
Brain Dead in 1992.
Known internationally as Dead Alive, this was the ultimate zombie comedy, renowned for its extreme gore.
It holds records, doesn't it, for being one of the goriest films ever made?
It does. It underwent extensive rewrites with Walsh, but despite the chaotic content, it secured him serious credibility in New Zealand, winning the NZ Film and TV Awards for Best Director and Best Screenplay.
So the splatter phase was messy, but it functioned as Jackson's film school. It taught him to direct, edit, manage effects, and create spectacle on a shoestring budget.
And the period immediately following Brain Dead represents the most decisive, strategic pivot in Jackson's entire career. He didn't just keep churning out genre horror.
No, he deliberately shifted to disciplined, critically sensitive drama with Heavenly Creatures in 1994.
And this was the move that forced the mainstream critical community to finally take him seriously.
And we have to credit Fran Walsh again for this change in direction. The material suggests it was her persuasion that led him to adapt the real-life, incredibly disturbing Parker Hall murder case from 1950s Christchurch.
Jackson stated it pretty clearly. He said the film only got made because of her deep enthusiasm for the subject matter. It was a shocking true story of adolescent delusion and violence.
Two teenage girls murdering one of their mothers to prevent being separated. Creatively, it was a massive risk, moving away from puppets and zombies to this nuanced psychological horror.
And it paid off handsomely, both artistically and commercially. It launched two major careers. Melanie Lynskey and Kate Winslet starred as Parker and Holm in their screen debuts.
The film's success wasn't just confined to the screen either. Its high profile led the New Zealand media to track down the real-life Juliet Holm,
who had completely reinvented herself as the highly successful, respectable mystery author Anne Perry.
Incredible.
The film's critical acclaim was immediate. It earned Jackson and Walsh an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay.
Which is a huge step for someone who had just directed a film involving a lawnmower massacring zombies.
And it also appeared on numerous prominent 1994 top 10 lists, signaling that Hollywood could no longer ignore him.
But before Jackson fully committed to Hollywood, he took one more fascinating detour that played with his own relationship to cinema and reality.
The mockumentary Forgotten Silver in 1995, co-directed with Costa Boats.
This is a remarkable piece of meta filmmaking. It chronicled the fictional story of a forgotten New Zealand film pioneer named Colin McKenzie,
who was supposedly the real inventor of color film and talkies, only to be, you know, erased from history.
And Jackson and Boats made it so convincing that many viewers genuinely believed they had uncovered a great lost cinematic hero.
I remember the uproar. The sources note that many viewers were outright outraged when they discovered the entire story was fictional.
It demonstrates not only his filmmaking skill, but his savvy understanding of New Zealand's national identity. This idea that the country's innovators are often forgotten by the wider world.
So, having proven he could master drama and deceive the masses, he took the leap into the American studio system with The Frighteners in 1996.
His first big-budget Hollywood film, starring Michael J. Fox.
But even though he took Hollywood money, Jackson made a critical stand. He insisted on shooting the entire comedy horror film in New Zealand.
Even though the story was set in North America.
Right. And that commitment to keeping his industry local was a defining trait he carried into the next phase.
However, the film,
it
faced severe headwinds. Commercially, it was considered a failure.
And critically, it received mixed reviews. Roger Ebert, a historically important film critic, was notably harsh. He described it as a film that looks more like a demo reel than a movie, suggesting the technology overshadowed the storytelling.
Ouch. And the aftermath of that failure was difficult. Jackson even launched legal proceedings against the New Zealand Listener magazine over a scathing review claiming the film was built from the rubble of other people's movies.
Though he later dropped the case. More significantly, though, the film's poor performance had immediate business repercussions.
Yes, and this is where the King Kong connection reappears, isn't it?
It is. Universal Studios, initially planning to bankroll Jackson's long-desired remake of King Kong, they shelved the project.
They were afraid of competition from other giant monster movies already in production, like Mighty Joe Young and Godzilla.
It was a bitter disappointment for Jackson, but it proved to be a critical turning point that necessitated, well, control.
And necessity is the mother of invention, right? This period of commercial disappointment and shelved projects directly fostered the rapid growth of what would become his greatest asset.
Wait, exactly.
He couldn't rely on Hollywood studios to always fund his vision, so he started building the ecosystem to do it himself.
Yeah.
Weta Workshop originally started with collaborators like George Port on Heavenly Creatures.
It just exploded during the Frighteners production.
Right. Led by Richard Taylor, Weta expanded rapidly, encompassing digital and physical effects, makeup, costumes. By keeping this capacity in-house and in New Zealand, Jackson gained unprecedented artistic control.
And this desire for control was clearly fueling his public conflicts at the time, particularly with the New Zealand Film Commission.
The very organization that helped finish Bad Taste.
Right.
This was a genuine public industry conflict. The tension dated back to budgetary issues with Meet the Feebles. In 1997, Jackson published a significant critique. He criticized the inconsistent decision-making by inexperienced board members. He was arguing their lack of industry experience was holding back New Zealand cinema.
It wasn't just a complaint. It was a demand for institutional change, showing his willingness to fight bureaucratic systems to protect his vision and the local industry. This really sets the stage for the massive, audacious gamble he was about to take.
The failure of The Frighteners and the subsequent shelving of King Kong, those moments of rejection and frustration, were so swiftly overcome when Jackson achieved the deal that would define the 21st century.
Securing the rights to film J.R.R. Tolkien's epic in 1997.
It was a monumental pivot back to ambition. Jackson acquired the rights after meeting with producer Saul Zantz. But what's fascinating, and often forgotten, is that this entire endeavor almost looked completely different.
The original plan with Miramax was to produce just two films.
And then Miramax applied enormous pressure on Jackson to condense the entirety of The Lord of the Rings, this massive, dense epic, into a single compressed film.
Which must have been an intolerable compromise for a filmmaker who had dedicated his career to realizing complex, detailed worlds.
It was. Jackson, alongside Walsh and Boyens, had already begun intensive work on the two-film script. But the single-film compromise was creatively impossible.
And this pressure led to a high-stakes, last-minute deal where he managed to move the project to New Line Cinema.
And crucially, New Line insisted not on one film but a full trilogy, providing the scale and scope that Tolkien's work truly demanded.
New Line's faith was historic. The scale of the resulting production was just unprecedented. Principal photography ran continuously for 14 months.
From October 1999 to December 2000, a massive undertaking that required extensive location filming all across New Zealand, effectively transforming the country into Middle Earth.
And we should pause for a personal detail that really highlights the intensity of this period. The sources note that Jackson's mother, Joan, passed away just 3 days before the release of the first film, The Fellowship of the Ring.
A special showing of the film was held after her funeral. It just reminds you of the profound personal sacrifice involved in such a massive creative endeavor.
Mm-hmm. The success, once they started rolling out, was staggering. The trilogy became a global cultural event, culminating in the historic Oscar domination for The Return of the King in 2003.
Domination is the right word. It achieved a historic tie for the most Academy Awards won by a single film, sweeping all 11 categories it was nominated for.
Including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Adapted Screenplay, which he shared with Walsh and Boyens.
And this wasn't just a win for Jackson. It was a revolutionary moment for Hollywood, wasn't it?
Oh, completely. It was the first time a fantasy film genre piece had ever won Best Picture. It also marked only the second time a sequel had won the top award following The Godfather Part II.
So Jackson's films were, collectively, the most awarded films at three separate Academy Award ceremonies in the early 2000s. It just cemented his status as a modern master of the blockbuster.
And with fantasy conquered, Jackson finally returned to his first love. Universal Studios, having burned him previously, signed Jackson a second time to remake the 1933 classic King Kong in 2005.
This was Jackson realizing his childhood obsession on a massive, state-of-the-art scale. The film was released to critical acclaim and generated strong commercial returns, grossing about US$562 million worldwide.
It wasn't just a film either. He fully embraced the medium, collaborating with Ubisoft on a critically and commercially successful video game adaptation using the same motion capture technology developed for Gollum.
Following these gargantuan epics, Jackson shifted gears again in 2009 with The Lovely Bones.
An adaptation of Alice Siebold's best-selling novel, Jackson described this project as a welcome relief from the high-pressure demands of...
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Blockbuster production.
But it still carried the dark DNA of his earlier non-genre work like Heavenly Creatures, dealing with murder, the afterlife, and fantasy elements.
But the results were mixed. Reviews were lukewarm, the box office returns were middling, though it did secure Stanley Tucci an Academy Award nomination for Supporting Actor.
Failures or mixed results like this, they're often insightful, right? They show the limits of applying a blockbuster aesthetic to an intimate emotional story.
Following The Lovely Bones, Jackson entered a significant collaboration with Steven Spielberg on The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn in 2011.
And Jackson co-wrote and produced while Spielberg directed.
This partnership was founded entirely on the technological prowess of Weta. Jackson didn't just produce, he helped Spielberg direct the film using performance capture technology, similar to what was refined for Gollum.
Spielberg wanted Jackson involved, specifically because of Weta Digital's expertise in translating human actors into photorealistic animated characters.
And the intention was for Jackson to direct the sequel, with Spielberg producing, a reversal of roles.
But that sequel has been perpetually delayed since 2011, while Spielberg has confirmed they know which two of Hergé's books they plan to combine.
Jackson has cited focusing on smaller New Zealand projects and, of course, the complexity of The Hobbit as reasons for the postponement. It's a high-profile, pending project that seems forever stuck in development hell.
Speaking of complexity, we have to address the troubled production of The Hobbit trilogy, which ran from 2012 to 2014. If LOTR was a triumph of collaboration, The Hobbit was a story of corporate friction and artistic commitment under pressure.
It had an extremely checkered history, rooted in old grudges. Initially, Jackson was completely barred from involvement due to his previous legal dispute with New Line Cinema.
Right, concerning the Fellowship of the Ring Prophets. This is where Robert Shea, the New Line head, made that famous statement that Jackson will never make any movie with New Line Cinema again while I'm still working at the company.
Which prompted an industry boycott call.
That deep-seated corporate friction eventually subsided, and Jackson returned, initially just as producer for two prequels, with Guillermo del Toro set to direct.
But del Toro eventually dropped out due to years of production delays, leaving the project rudderless just before shooting.
And Jackson, despite publicly stating he was reluctant to step back into the director's chair for such a demanding project, he felt compelled to take over.
And this is the moment where critics often raise their eyebrows. Jackson took a single, relatively short children's book and expanded the plan two films into a three-part trilogy.
That decision generated huge commercial success, but also significant artistic critique. To justify the length, Jackson and his co-writers incorporated extensive material from the Lord of the Rings appendices.
And the central critique focused on pacing. The question was stretching the story purely a commercial decision?
It's a complex analysis. Commercially, yes, it maximized profit and kept the Middle-earth industrial complex running.
Artistically, though, Jackson and Walsh argued that incorporating the appendices allowed them to bridge the gap between The Hobbit and the seriousness of LOTR. But ultimately, critics and many fans felt the narrative suffered from bloat.
Regardless, his willingness to return confirmed his absolute control over the entire cinematic universe, securing his position at the center of the franchise.
Having mastered fiction, Jackson executed arguably the most surprising pivot of his career, applying Weta sophisticated technology not to fantasy, but to historical reality through documentaries.
This begins with his World War I restoration project.
They Shall Not Grow Old in 2018. This was Jackson leveraging Weta's technology for history. He took original, damaged, often unseen footage from the Imperial War Museums.
And his personal passion for WWI aviation fed directly into the historical accuracy and respect for the material.
The techniques they applied were revolutionary. They didn't just splice the footage together. Jackson's team employed complex, modern techniques to colorize the black and white film, convert the frame rate, sharpen the image,
and even convert it to stereoscopic 3D. But the most moving piece of restoration was the audio.
Absolutely. The original footage was silent or contained only ambient noise. Jackson hired forensic lip readers to determine exactly what the soldiers were saying in the footage.
And then they dubbed in realistic regional accents synchronized to the lip movements. This act brought the soldiers back to life in an almost hyper-real way.
The critical response reflected that immersive experience. Critics called the effect electrifying, noting that the soldiers, who were previously just ghosts in grainy, sped-up footage, were returned to an eerie, hyper-real kind of life.
And while the film was technically ineligible for the Academy Awards due to its unique release and funding structure, it earned a BAFTA nomination for Best Documentary.
This technological framework restoring and enhancing old, difficult source material was instantly recognizable when he tackled his next massive project, The Beatles, Get Back in 2021.
This documentary focused on the making of Let It Be, an album famously associated with the band's painful breakup.
And Jackson was granted access to an incredible 55 hours of never-before-seen footage and 140 hours of audio. He used the same restoration techniques developed for WWI to transform the visual quality.
His goal was specific, wasn't it? To challenge the prevailing narrative that this period was one of unrelenting conflict.
Exactly. By restoring the footage, he aimed to show a new side, the camaraderie, the silliness, and the creative collaboration that was often overshadowed by the breakup narrative.
The scope of the project demanded a three-part series release on Disney Plus MoMA. It featured the full 42-minute final rooftop concert, and the critical consensus was immense.
It won 5 Primetime Emmy Awards, including Outstanding Documentary or Nonfiction Series, and personally for Jackson, Outstanding Directing.
But here's where Jackson's technological ingenuity moves beyond cinema and physically alters music history.
The audio demixing technology, developed specifically by the Weta team for Get Back, it allowed them to take a single combined audio track, vocals, drums, guitars, and isolate each instrument or vocal performance.
So explain that demixing process for us. Why was this such a groundbreaking technical feat, especially in audio restoration?
Well, think of it this way. Historically, once instruments and vocals were mixed down onto a single tape track, they were permanently glued together. Trying to separate John Lennon's voice from the piano bleed on an old demo was nearly impossible without severe degradation.
So Weta's machine learning and AI algorithms learned to recognize specific sonic signatures.
Right. Lennon's voice, a specific drum kit, and they could essentially unglue the elements, allowing them to isolate vocals or drums from the background noise and each other with unprecedented clarity.
That is truly revolutionary. And that technology immediately found commercial application. It was used to improve the audio quality of the Revolver, special edition reissue in 2022.
And most famously, that demixing technology was the crucial key to salvaging and completing Now and Then, dubbed The Last Beatles Song, released in 2023.
They took a raw, noisy 1977 demo tape by John Lennon, isolated his vocal track using the demixing process, combined it with recordings made in 1995, and then added new input from McCartney and Starr.
Without Jackson's technology, that song would have remained unusable due to the poor quality of the vocal isolation. It's that simple.
Jackson also directed the accompanying music video for Now and Then, which mixed new footage of McCartney and Starr with carefully restored old footage to visually include all four Beatles.
This integration received a mixed response. While emotionally powerful, some critics and viewers found the visual integration of the deceased members into recent footage slightly uncanny or jarring.
Right. Jackson himself noted he was initially very reluctant to direct the video, but was persuaded by the infectious enthusiasm of the surviving members.
And this period of intense technological development also coincided with a massive shift in his financial status.
Jackson became a certified billionaire in 2021.
That massive valuation was achieved when he sold Weta, specifically the digital division Weta Digital to Unity Technologies, a leading interactive 3D gaming business.
This sale highlighted that Jackson hadn't just built a film studio asset, he had built a globally significant technology company.
The result placed him and Fran Walsh, his partner and co-owner, very high on the NBR Rich List in 2025, with an estimated net worth of around $2.6 billion.
It confirms Jackson's status as a technological entrepreneur as much as a filmmaker. And outside of cinema, his diverse business and personal interests are just as compelling.
Starting with that lifelong obsession that fed into They Shall Not Grow Old, World War I aviation.
He is an absolute fanatic. His interest is so deep that he actually owns an aircraft restoration and manufacturing company, the Vintage Aviator.
Which is dedicated to the painstaking restoration and recreation of WWI and WWI fighter planes. He personally owns a collection of over 40 airworthy WWI-era warbirds.
A collection of historical artifacts you can actually fly.
He also chairs the 1418 Aviation Heritage Trust and has been generous with his collection, notably donating replica aircraft for the over-the-front multimedia display at the Australian War Memorial.
He also previously owned Waynut Wings, a scale modeling company specializing in WWI subjects.
Which, while it closed in 2020, just underscores the depth of his detailed passion for this era. His interests stretch much further than history and aviation, though.
He purchased and saved Bats Theater in Wellington from demolition in 2011, showing a commitment to local arts infrastructure.
And then there's the science aspect, where his capital supports genuinely ambitious, disruptive goals.
You're talking about his investment in Colossal Biosciences.
Exactly. Jackson invested in this bioscience company, which has the specific, ambitious aim of de-extinction.
Bringing back extinct creatures, most famously the woolly mammoth.
It showcases his willingness to put serious capital behind technology that pushes boundaries, whether it's visual effects, audio restoration, or genetic science. He's always funding the next disruptive innovation.
It's clear that his influence is not limited to the silver screen. We should also touch on the more idiosyncratic details of his collection, like owning the main driving Chitty Chitty Bang Bang car built for the film.
And he's not afraid to use his clout locally. The sources point to his involvement in Wellington local politics in 2019, where he supported a mayoral candidate with $30,000 in funding.
And this support reportedly influenced the election result by a tiny margin of just 62 votes, stemming primarily from a long-running property development dispute at Shelly Bay.
It's a remarkable demonstration of his desire to shape the physical as well as the creative environment around him.
To understand Jackson's massive output, we have to look closely at the man directing, his methodology, his collaborators, and his reputation for being an intense perfectionist.
That label is well earned. Jackson is known for his almost compulsive attention to detail, which is often paired with a macabre sense of humor and a general playfulness.
The bad taste sensibilities are still lingering.
Oh, absolutely. But that perfectionism translated directly into long, demanding hours on set, particularly during the LOTR era.
We have those incredible anecdotes from legendary actors like Christopher Lee and Ian McKellen, who spoke about his habit of demanding numerous takes.
Often asking for one more for luck.
Lee recalled having 12 takes for one scene, and Ian McKellen famously did 24 takes for just two lines of dialogue on one particularly grueling day.
And this is directly tied to a signature Jackson trademark, his insistence on coverage. For you listeners who might not be familiar with the term, coverage means shooting a scene from virtually every angle imaginable.
Wide shots, medium shots, close-ups from the left, close-ups from the right.
High angles, low angles. He does this to maximize his editing options in post-production, sometimes spending days capturing a single short scene, but ensuring he has every possible permutation available in the editing room.
And visually, this manifests in specific, recognizable trademarks. That wide array of multiple camera angles, and his unique use of wide-angle lenses for close-ups on actors' faces.
Right. A wide-angle lens typically distorts perspective slightly, often making the face look more imposing or intense, drawing the viewer deeper into the emotional space of the character.
He was also, throughout his career, a significant early adopter of computer enhancement technology, even before LOTR. He began utilizing and providing digital special effects to Hollywood films.
Establishing Wade's reputation long before The Ring came into play, his self-taught trial-and-error mentality made him uniquely receptive to new disruptive technologies.
He has also definitely adopted the Alfred Hitchcock tradition. He is a true cameo king.
He appears in most of the films he directs, and even in some he only produces.
And these cameos are more than just quick background shots. They are specific, fun details. Beyond his two lead roles in Bad Taste, he was the mortician's assistant in Braindead.
In Heavenly Creatures, he was the tramp kissed by Juliet Holm, a jarring bit of levity in an otherwise intense film.
The Lord of the Rings cameos are perhaps the most famous. He is the carrot-chomping citizen of Bree in Fellowship of the Ring.
And in The Two Towers, he's one of the spear-throwing defenders of Helm's Deep.
In Return of the King, he ramps up the detail. He played the bosun of a corsair ship, who is accidentally killed by Legolas in the extended version.
A character so memorable in his brief appearance that an action figure was actually made of him.
And then there's the bizarre practical detail that his own hands stood in for Sean Astin's hands when Sam was being wrapped in cobweb by Shelob due to Astin's temporary absence from the set.
He even inserted a clever meta reference into his most beloved project. In his 2005 King Kong remake, he appeared as a biplane gunner attacking Kong.
Which was a direct, respectful reprise of the cameo made by the original 1933 film's director, Marion C. Cooper.
And it really is a family business. His partner, Fran Walsh, and both their children, Billy and Katie, have made consistent cameos throughout his major filmography since the mid-90s.
From The Frighteners right through The Hobbit trilogy, even the portraits of Bilbo's parents, Bungo Baggins and Belladonna Took, seen at the end of the Battle of the Five Armies,
were painted in the likeness of Jackson and Walsh.
Which brings us back to Fran Walsh. We've mentioned her numerous times, but we have to reinforce her importance. She is far more than a partner. She is the creative co-pilot and the thematic anchor of his entire career.
Absolutely. She has been his partner since 1987 and is an essential collaborator, a co-writer, producer, and lyricist on every film since Meet the Feebles. Their work is inseparable.
Her contributions were formally recognized when she shared the three Academy Awards Jackson won for The Return of the King.
Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, and even Best Original Song for Into the West.
In total, she has received 7 Oscar nominations, making her one of the most essential and sometimes undercredited figures in modern blockbuster cinema.
She often brings the necessary emotional gravity and grounded sensibility to Jackson's otherwise technologically maximalist ambitions, pushing him toward projects like Heavenly Creatures and grounding the emotional intensity of LOTR.
So, looking back, Sir Peter Jackson's career trajectory is truly monumental. He navigated the difficult transition from self-taught splatter king to mainstream respectability with Heavenly Creatures.
He used that success to establish Weta, not just a studio, but an unparalleled visual effects powerhouse. He conquered Hollywood with LOTR, winning 11 Oscars and redefining the fantasy genre.
And in his later career, he achieved a new level of versatility, pivoting to historically accurate documentaries and musical preservation, demonstrating that Weta's restoration technology is now a globally important asset.
Capable of giving new life to history, music, and even potentially extinct creatures, his national honors reflect this standing.
Indeed. His official standing is secured both nationally and internationally. He was knighted as a Knight Companion of the New Zealand Order of Merit in 2010.
And received New Zealand's highest civilian honor in 2012 as an additional member of the Order of New Zealand.
And his involvement with Middle Earth is far from over. Warner Bros. Discovery recently confirmed that Jackson, Fran Walsh, and Philippa Boyens will produce a new Lord of the Rings film, The Lord of the Rings, The Hunt for Gollum, set for release in 2027.
With Andy Serkis directing. And Wellington is confirmed as the production hub, confirming that Jackson remains the central creative and industrial force of that franchise.
So we've tracked Jackson's journey from a young boy obsessed with stop-motion King Kong to a technology billionaire who can literally restore the Beatles' final music.
We know his lifelong passion for King Kong and WWI aviation, and we know he is deeply invested in Colossal Biosciences, aiming to bring back the woolly mammoth.
This raises the final fascinating question for you, the listener. We've seen Jackson transition from low-budget horror to high fantasy epics, and then to intense forensic historical restoration.
Knowing his unique blend of technological mastery, cinematic ambition, and obsessive detail, and given that he's already investing heavily in life sciences and aviation history,
what new field of reality or fiction will his particular brand of visionary expertise choose to conquer next? What unexplored corner of the world is waiting for the Peter Jackson treatment?
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.